Não. Abelha boa.
Translate to English.
Yeah, that's
okay. What's the
okay? We can start. I'm sorry for taking some time. I don't understand why I'm not able to, because it's 15:15. So, of course, I need to extend probably. No. Okay. The exercise we did it a little bit the wrong way, because one of the ideas from my side, at least, it was to first speak about validity. I mean, what makes a case, a method good and bad? We have to have some criteria, and this criteria is the criteria of validity, which you are going to find in chapter 4 in the book of practical research. Probably that would be, I mean, it's by luck, the accident, serendipity we call it in the language of methodology. Serendipity means happy accidents. So you're creating the conditions so that happy accidents may be created. Well, I didn't that purposely, but hopefully that was for you. And the idea is then, let's find out how, did you work together or in groups or individually? How
discussed it.
You discussed in the perfect, that's a perfect way of doing it. And probably also the discussion, because I forgot to take off the microphone, so probably this discussion has been not so broadcasted through the entire world. So, is one of you that would like to come with some suggestions of how is it possible to solve? First of all, I purposely didn't mention one thing, and this is the resources. What kind of resources do you have? Perfect. This is exactly the practical side and the philosophical methodological side. Both must fit together. So. Shall I ask one of you? You discuss it as one unit, isn't it? So, is it enough if one of you would present some other of the ideas how to conduct the study?
Sure.
I know Andrew is, but this time I would like to ask someone else. What about you?
Feel free. If you don't, you are not very, very happy with this, then next time. Just feel free to...
next time.
Are you sure?
Yes.
I'm sure you can do it.
But I need more thinking about the sentences now.
Yes, okay.
And if the other one can continue,
okay.
You can continue.
So you can collaborate with Lucas.
I actually have to admit that I didn't quite get it if we answered the question right. So
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I can present what we wrote down.
Would you like to have the you can perfectly have it. I mean, we can do that.
I don't have an adapter for HDMI actually, so.
Ah.
I would have to have my other adapter for.
Yes.
I can just write it on the board.
Please.
I can write and you can talk, maybe?
Yes. Nice.
and their places.
For the first, or we just answered the three questions, how would you use the case studies? How many would you have conducted and in which areas?
Yes.
So we said we would be likely to compare R&D budgets or spendings in different sectors or companies. So as I understood, quantitative research, if I got that right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you are free to implement the study more or less as you understand it.
Then we would have to find out which of the sectors we want to research on are eligible for funding by BIA. That's what I first thought because I was focused on BIA. But if we look at EU-wide, maybe it's not that smart to be limited on BIA because it's only for Norwegian companies. So
you're right.
And then we said we could either have one EU-wide case for each sector or... I'm not sure if I got that right. Like one big case or each sector could have its single case in the EU, if that's understandable.
Absolutely.
Next question, how many cases would you have conducted? We looked at the, it was 7 sectors that were presented in the BIA 2016 fundings. Then we talked a little bit about why the public sector isn't a part of that, if we should include that, and of course it's not a public, it's not included in the BIA spendings because BIA is funding private sector.
Yes. Right.
But we should maybe consider public sector too in that research. And also the financial sector, which we thought could have been included by production of commodities, but a detailed research on that would be smart too. So we ended up with 9, so let's say 2 to 10 cases, if you,
2 to 10 cases per sector?
It depends. It depends on how we answer the question before then. Like if we say, okay, we make one big case about all of you, and then we have one big case of 10 sectors, or we have 10 cases of like one case per sector. I don't know where to draw the line there, if it's smart to have more cases or one case. Yeah, also what you just wrote down, the time series, so make the case in 2010 or maybe one in 2017 and compare the outcome to see if there's a development. Yeah, and then in which areas or the local area or the major area would be called EU, and then which sectors that were the ones we wrote down there. I don't think you have to write them all down again. You
can
refer to the whiteboard. Yep, that at least represents my notes on the questions, if any of you would like to add something.
Any additions, additional thoughts, sectors missing? Of course, when it comes to BIA, we need to have somewhere here the oil sector, I suppose.
And we talked about that as well.
Process industries, yeah.
Yes.
That must be the production of commodities. It depends on how we because production can be many things. Yeah? So either process or here production. Or,
yeah.
Other comments? Any additions?
For all countries, for example, but then seafoods, so we have to add this vegetarian in our list as well. So it's not devoted just to a special country, it's for all countries.
Good. Another really important thing is that kind of the question is still really broad, so we would really need to define our question better to kind of look at maybe one thing instead of the whole area. I think that would be a way too time consuming. So maybe we talked about budgetary limits and so on. So it really depends on how much money we have to spend, but how much money, how much time do we have, and so on. Do we want to do a multi-sector case study at one time, or do we want a time series study, and so on. So there's a lot of possibilities. Okay. But it all has to start with a problem sentence.
Yeah.
It has to be really specific for us to find any good answers. We're talking about doing a quantitative study, and really depends on how much information can we find and how comparable are the data we find, so we can use kind of statistical methods and all that stuff.
This is exactly the whole point with this exercise. Thank you guys very much. Because I will adopt this approach method. So that first we have an exercise and then the validity and not vice versa, because this is much, much, much better. Thank you very much. You know what? You are very close to what it actually has been done. This is a reference. The reference is that one. The time where I worked in this project, it was one of the largest social science projects funded by the EU at that time. It was the sixth framework program that was the funding source, but that wasn't a research project. It was a commissioned project, and it was the Directorate of Trade who asked for that. You know, it's exactly as we have here in Norway. We have the Ministry of Trade and the Ministry of education and the research. It's pretty much the same thing, also division of the EU. So EU wanted to decide it, and everything started actually with one book. I'm not exaggerating, actually. Everything started with one book, which encapsulated the idea of that we do not have only, and now I'm entering into subjects that outside of the realm of this course, but I think that it is fundamental concepts to discuss in general for sustainable manufacturing. So if a very crash course on innovation studies, for 20 years ago, we started to discuss the issue of national innovation systems. The idea of national innovation system, that within a nation, you have institutions and you have resources, you have styles, you have cultures, that all of them together, they provide a kind of a certain type of innovation activity, which is different from the country in Sweden, and Scandinavia is a perfect example about that. We definitely know now, after these kind of studies, exactly focusing on national innovation systems, that the innovation system of Norway is very different from Denmark, very different from the Swedish one, and there are numbers of studies about that to document that. But then the next question was, yes, okay, we understand that, but what about the structure of the economy? I mean, the Norwegian economy is much more based on oil and fisheries compared to the Swedish one, which is much more based on the automotives and the more manufacturing activities, as well as the ICT. And not to mention the Danish activity, which is the Danish economy, which is much more and not so much concentrated, it's much more diverse. And now we have also data about that. Next time, remind me, I will send you a link from Harvard, actually, showing, it's a fantastic visualization tool on showing the different specialization of different countries, depending on what you're looking at. You're looking at BNP and the share of the BNP from different sectors, or the R&D activities, or the exports activities, or the import activities. you know, or based on that you can have a visualization type and showing the differences, the different profiles between countries. Okay, so the idea is that the idea was that okay, the idea behind the sectoral innovation systems was exactly that different sectors, they have different value chains. Different value chains, they impose different client relationships, different customer relationships, different relationships connected to also to customers, and all these create a kind of value chain which is not only value chain as value, but it is first of all the production of knowledge. This is very close to what Halvor is presenting to you this semester. So they are I'm very consciously now referring to that. Did he mention the terms national innovation system and sector innovation system? If no, then that's perfect, because this means that it's a good connection here. So on that basis, I just took an example. So now we covered the main idea. So the idea is that national innovation systems, actually, it's a byproduct of, in reality, the structure of the economy, which is based again on the sectoral innovation system, meaning the whole value chains, the logic of the manufacturing sector, by the way, the openness or closeness concerning the trade activities, the globality of it or not. And of course also very well what you mentioned, the type of R&D, what kind of R&D activity, how much R&D, how much innovation, how many patents, how many publications, how many universities, how strong universities in these areas and so on. We're talking about, and of course the last things that I mentioned could be also studied within national innovation system perspective, but also sectoral innovation system perspective. And so the localization of companies, where are they compared to, let's say, the knowledge centers, particularly the universities in general, but also research institutes. Germany, for instance, if there is one institution outside the university that we have to remember from this, generally from this master course, not only course, but also from the master study program, is one institution which is not university. Which is it? Now I have to harass him. That's a fantastic institution. There are many, actually, in Germany. Germany has a very interesting agglomeration of different research institutes as well. I'm talking about the Fraunhofer, which is the most important technological institution in Europe, outside universities. I have to underline that. So all these ideas. So the question is, just to go back to the question is, can we talk meaningfully about understanding innovation behavior within economic sectors, and do they differ really? Is it, can we find, how can I say, can we have find, and in this particular project we invent actually a concept of which is called innovation mode, which is very easy to extend to innovation sectoral modes. And the question then is, how are we going to provide, visualize the differences between sectors that do not copy the differences between nations? Right? So that was the question that actually, it wasn't our question, it was the question of the policymakers, it was the question of the EU wanting to boost the innovation activity within all sectors, and not only one or two, and not only within the high part, the high-tech part of it, like ICT, which is, and particularly biomedicine, where here they are spending, if you know that, more than 20% of the turnover of these companies here, more than 20% are going to end it. More than 20%, which means if you do mistakes here, then you are out in 10 years. If you do not invest correctly on your R&D, you are out. And we're talking about now colossal companies.
one of them, AstraZeneca, was Swedish, isn't it? We have also the one branch here in Norway as well, in Oslo. And you had the question.
And it kind of has to be some sort of correlation between technological needs or development needs and different markets and the need for innovation as well.
There is a very close relationship.
So
this is yeah. Oh, sorry, I interrupted.
So you can kind of have an idea or an hypothesis about how much innovation work goes into different sectors compared to how the markets move.
Yeah.
And that would kind of give you a good starting point for why some sectors develop fast and some not.
Yes, and there is also another question, very, very familiar, very interesting for us and also for persons working in within the oil sector. As you know, no, probably you don't know that. Let me start a little differently. I just mentioned the biomedicine area or the medical research, which is huge, huge. It is also huge within the university world. More than 30% of global publications are within the medicine sector. Health in general, of course. Why the idea of, and this is one probably, check this reference, don't read it necessarily, is one of the interesting persons within the history and also the theory of innovation. It's Mr. Malher Bach. He is Italian, actually. He published a book together with some other co-authors, but he was exactly the, I know him personally as well, he was the driver behind the idea of a sector innovation system. And it was exactly based on the observation that some sectors are very heavily relied within on R&D to develop themselves, to innovate, other sectors not. For example, the oil sector. It is an insult also for many oil companies in Norway, because they feel that in the paper, I mean, they fund quite a lot of R&D, but not that much as a share of their turnover as, let's say, the companies within the medicine, the pharmaceuticals companies. Am I clear on that? The share. So shall I repeat that? The share of the turnover of oil companies going to R&D is minuscule compared to the share of the turnover of the pharmaceutical companies. So from this particular perspective, then the oil companies are classified as low-tech sectors compared to pharmaceuticals and many others, ICT as well. Huh? So this is the idea. So the question is, how come these differences? And why is it so? And it turns out also that within the oil sector we have a lot of innovation is taking place in non-R&D type activities, in non-project innovation type activities. It takes innovation can be the production of platform. Look, I don't want to enter into this discussion because it's a huge, it's a completely different course, actually. So let's not enter into that. This is just meant as an example for what was the motivation of this study and of the EU. And the question is how we solve it, and very much it was solved on the basis of how you thought that it should be solved. A little different structure of the sectors, just a little different. We had the inside the chemical sector, for instance. We had the energy production sector. It was my responsibility that when I was working at the, and of course oil companies was just a part of it. We're talking about the energy, including the electricity. That was one sector. The automobile or automotive sector, which signified it, produced of course the reports for all sectors. The final reports from all the sectors. We had also the automotive sector was the one, not the fisheries, of course, because very much EU wasn't so much interested in fisheries alone. This is a typical example of what is common added value in an EU area. It would have been unthinkable not to include fisheries in a Norwegian perspective. But Norway, of course, is a tiny, tiny, tiny spot in the entire EU, and fisheries was there. One of the sectors that I'm sure you would never have guessed, it was the craftsmanship, the craftsman sector, called it. Small, tiny enterprises within the creative industries, which we can call it, either music or pottery, artists, art in general, ceramics and this kind of thing. Not ceramics, sorry, I meant pottery. Ceramics is actually a research field. Construction, very important area, neglected, extremely low tech. They are innovative, but they are innovate slowly. And so, you know, on that basis, then we just only to think about the structure and the structure based on what is important and what is not important at the EU level, it was one big methodological choice. That was the one. The second one was, of course, the budgetary constraints. We had the 4 million euros. Huh? 4 million euros, it is 40 million crowns. Not a small amount of money, but for this kind of stuff, it was very, very small. It was very tight, the project. And the idea was exactly, we went quantitatively first. We just gathered whatever data it was possible to find, including something which is not stated here, obviously, because I never mentioned it, and it is perfectly understandable. There is a kind of a survey which is called CIS Community Innovation Survey, which is conducted in all European countries for many, 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 many years. So you have quite longitudinal data. I will define what it is, meaning that you have data from all these surveys every year back to some countries will have it back to 70s. And this is both innovation and R&D statistics. Huh? I worked personally at the micro level, meaning at the company level data on that, together, put all over together for the entire EU. Huge databases, fantastic, interesting, extremely interesting data material to study. Only on this CIS, and on the basis of the questions that the questionnaire had, that it was possible, and on the basis, of course, of the answers of the particular companies within the different countries, it was possible to draw some conclusions that the companies within, let's say, chemistry, tend to answer one particular direction compared to the others. So that was, for us, an indication of different innovation modes. Is it valid? That remains to discuss that. But it wasn't only that. Back to the question of what we had here, you know, because that was a typical multiple method approach. So we had both a quantitative analysis. We studied all technological patterns within the different sectors. We studied also the publications. We studied economic data. And we studied also trade data. That was one branch of study, which you have here, and this is very, very interesting. The relevant sectors I just mentioned, one of the difficulties here is exactly to put all this in sectors and study the differences. Eh? And of course, how we study the difference, this comes a little bit later on in the next weeks of this course. We are going to see how is it possible to credibly decide, oh, here we have a difference, significantly, statistically speaking, and here we do not have a difference. Huh? This is something that we're going to learn. And when we came down to, so I just described now several, there was something again that it's not here, but it is important. We know that institutions play a role. By institution, I just mean the judicial system. The tax system, the tax system in Norway is quite different compared to the German one. Huh? Let's say, do we have a tax credit schemes in Norway? Yes, we have. Do we have in all countries in the EU? No. Tax credit scheme means that when you are conducting R&D, you can present that and deduct that from your profit report. So you do not pay tax on the part of that makes your R&D. Huh? This is tax
credit system, it's called. Which is we call it scatophon, you know, just for you to it's scatophon, that one. Anyone familiar with the word scatophon? Have you heard that before? No.
Scatophon.
Yeah. Check that. Okay. Now I used quite a lot of time in order to describe the background, but we had also, of course, the case study approach in the sense of not of the data that you just described, Lucas, but also the case study of approaching how are you going to approach the sectors. I mean, what kind of case study are you going to design on that basis? So you have two possibilities: companies within a sector spread across the entire Europe, and also the policy level, the policy in the sense, the policy, the decision level. So we had two work packages. The one was on particular companies, which has been discussed. First of all, just to show you how we worked on the particular kit, because I think that this is relevant and interesting for your next future research, probably. First, we had the experts. First, we gathered the experts of within the different sectors, and not in R&D, not only knowledge, but also policymakers, representatives from big businesses, or representatives of most of these, because of course we have to know that these are not empty entities. These are entities that are full of social life. They are integrated within national, associations, and these associations, then again, they are structured in a European association and global associations as well. It is either within scientific subjects or I mean, there are within biomedicine, there are at least 100 different associations of this type, which focusing either within R&D or within production or within the ethical issues and so on and so on. So remember that this is, of course, a very complex animal that we're studying here. So in order to get into the individual, because you have to look at the individual companies as well, we had to have expert acknowledgement that the choices of the companies that we had to come as a list, and we used the technological, the patterns. We used many different sources in order to come down to some representative companies throughout the Europe within each one of these sectors. Then we present this list to the experts, which was about 20, and we had four gatherings of these experts where they got, first of all, to their knowledge, and they approved the list of the companies, and then we present the results of each one of the work packages, of the quantitative analysis, of the interviews of the particular companies synthesized, of course, of the type of sector, and also the very end, the synthesis of the synthesis report that you've seen here. What is it? Quite a lot of work, actually, as you imagine. We are here. Yeah, this kind of, I produced the energy sector. If you Google energy, my name, and also the name of a colleague, you are going to find it, sectoral, energy sector, then I think that they are going to find it. So, this was our solution for this particular question of do we have different, and of course, the whole idea, if you ask me, okay, after 4 million euros, what was the result? Are there or are there not different sectoral innovation systems? Well, the question or the answer, at least my understanding, we produced something like 50 different reports, both at the sector level, but also, you know, the cross-cutting questions. The answer, the short story is yes, but conditioned to national innovation systems. Probably national innovation system means more than sectoral innovation systems. That is, the how within different nations
states, countries, how the innovation takes place. And if, for instance, for in Germany, automotive is fundamentally core issue. I mean, almost everything resolves around it. Services, ICT, exports, of course, leverandeurs, suppliers, and so on. Not that very much different from the point of view of the Norwegian side until recently now. We are, again, remember, omstilling. You remember what omstilling is, yeah? The structural change about Norway and Norwegian economic structure.
So the point is, just to underline, again, this is a big parenthesis, not relevant for this subject here, but the result of this 4 million study was, yes, conditionally, two, that you have to always take into account national innovation system differences and how they condition the production or the geographical structure of the economic sectors within Europe. For it's, so to speak, the manufacturing innovation system in Germany is not necessarily the same as in Norway. Please keep that in mind. If you study manufacturing in Norway, it's not necessarily the same. And the knowledge development activities within Norway in manufacturing is not the same, necessarily the same as in Germany. And we can see that on the concentration of what kind of patents, for instance, are taking place within certain topics in Norway compared to, among other things, publications as well. And so let me don't enter too details. Konstantin,
you... is there anything that I'm saying which is not fitting
I think I agree with what you said earlier about the process industry. My feeling is they're not launching to new ideas or innovations. They stick to old ideas.
Yeah. The funny thing, because it's very funny what you're saying, because I present
conservative.
I present this our report that was not this, that of course it was the energy report. Since we were Norwegian researchers, we present our findings also from relatively large research project to the Ministry of Oil and Energy, and they start to ask how is it possible. I mean, yes, it is possible. There are some differences between the Norwegian sector and also energy sector and also the European energy sector. In Europe in general, until very recently, remember that we are talking about also Spain, we're talking about Greece, we're talking about many other places, we have almost still monopolies, but they are not favoring any particular innovation there. So how the market is also being reflects this kind of how much innovation, how much research are you doing within a certain country. Back again to the question, national innovation system versus sectoral innovation systems. So I absolutely agree with you. I mean, it is disgrace, if you ask me, how little is invested and how much profit this sector is doing, the energy sector in general, not only... I'm not talking about oil companies. On the contrary, many of the oil companies now, they are funding the new generation of sustainable energy sources, actually. We know that. There are many interesting projects there. Statnet is the key actor for offshore wind production in England.
Another point, I might be wrong here, but why would you need innovation in Norway? And it seems that the government are putting rules. Let's say if you want to have less taxations, we can support you with funding. on how you can do better with respect to pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would do innovation. But this is again more the government or that they're putting rules in place instead of people thinking, let's make money.
Absolutely. I think I understand.
Short, you know, very roughly.
In my understanding, of course, we can discuss exactly this particular, but your point is institution matters.
Yes.
Institution matters in general,
yeah,
because they are incentives to all companies, and also to all companies in how they evolve in doing innovation and also research. And this is why I mentioned also the tax credit system that we have here in Norway. It's very, very, very popular, actually, also for particularly for SMEs. Andre, you had a comment?
Yeah, I mean, you have to take the cost-benefit calculation into account as well, because certain sectors kind of, it takes a lot of investment to kind of apply the innovation. So even though there's certainly innovations available, there has to be kind of this time period before you can actually start to apply them because of the cost of kind of new machinery, new technology. So certain kind of sectors can do that more quickly, like biomedicine. You can develop new ideas and new medicines quite quickly, while kind of manufacturing and all those sectors, it usually takes a bit more time.
That's absolutely. I'm very happy having this discussion, you know, because we are entering, you know, from a certain point of view, I'm sure all of you are feeling that this is out of the scope of this course. But on the other hand, if you think, we're trying to think now, what are the important issues for sustainable manufacturing? For a study within sustainable manufacturing, huh? Infrastructure, I mean, the length of the technology maturity of a particular solution that we want to adopt or not. I remind you, though these things that I'm going to mention now are not included as R&D spending and R&D investment, remember that all the oil platforms that we have had here in Norway for the last 30 years, including also the vessels that are developed now, not platform, not the physical stable platforms, but vessels now trying to extract oil, all this has been a continuous development, a continuous knowledge, deep development, and very costly developments that, of course, Norway profited enormously out of. And despite that, I mean, the criticism, which I believe that here we have to think what we are saying, the criticism to the oil sector is that they invest too little of the turnover. But the question is, you cannot invest whatever you want. You have to find some, you have to see the opportunities in order to invest. We leave that here. And if you have any other questions, if you have some questions related to our project was called Systematic. That was our name of the project. The EU decided that there is another much more sexy title, and they called it Sector Innovation Watch, and it has been then, it was the first study for Sector Innovation Watch, meaning that it's not only important to understand, to watch the R&D activities, innovation activities at the country level, but also at the sector level. And this is also, I mean, this is Europe Innova, it's another company who got responsibility for serving this kind of web pages and this kind of thing. Europe Innova, it's just a name, nothing else than that. So, I hope that you enjoyed this as a case study. And now let's think a little bit. Now we're coming backwards. We're moving towards our friend Hans Christian. Let's think a little bit of what we have done. I mean, you tried to resonate, to find a method which represents the reality, isn't it? Which represents more or less the complex animal called sectors within EU-wide. Huh? which is an extremely complex thing. And you wanted, you tried immediately and also spontaneously to find methods, to find approaches in order to provide answers which are valid. So let's think a little bit more carefully now about the validity of the issue. Again, I just point out that we are talking about the chapter 4. And then I will go a little bit more in detail into the issue of quantitative and qualitative methods. We already have had actually one almost whole hour on the issue of case studies. Let's start with a definition. Always good to have some definition to work with. So my suggestion about the definition of validity is that the likelihood that the approach chosen will yield accurate, meaningful, and credible results. Okay, accurate, meaningful, and credible results. Nothing of these three, again, I'm now referring to the Hans Christian's points here, nothing of these three are standing alone as a undisputable concept without a reference to something. Nothing is meaningful without a reference to something. It's meaningful in relation to something. The same with the logic. Nothing is logic unless it is logical in relation to something. So if someone says that this is not logic and you think that it is absolutely logical, probably you have two different contexts of that you relate the logic. Well, you operate under different logical systems. This is my point. So the accurate is something that can be discussed, and then actually is much more referred to the accurate, in particular when it comes to quantitative analysis. Then we have a little bit more global standards and more also throughout the disciplines standard to discuss the word accurate. I mean, it's particularly we're going to see statistical differences, and we're going to test statistical differences. In that particular case, we know not exactly what accuracy means. We don't know that, but we know into what level we can be sure that this is in an accurate approximately level, that here there is an actual difference against to something which is not difference. It's a statistical artifact. This is why we are going to use SPSS and we are going to use a little bit more statistics. So, and then again, accurate and meaningful and credible results, and this all together then provides the gut feeling of here I have a serious piece of work that needs a little bit more study compared to many others that do not make sense. I have many, many examples. One of the examples for you that can read Norwegian, I'm sorry for you others that are not necessarily very versatile in Norwegian. It is a fantastic, interesting example about, just going on this discussion, about whether the Oslo school is the best one in Norway or not. And there is a fascinating controversy between different interests on whether to discredit or provide credit to very thorough, to myself, in my understanding, very thorough reports, one from NTNU, the other one from the Statistics Central Bureau, you know, the Statistics Norway, the Statistics Central Bureau, about the contribution of the schools to the youngsters, to the pupils, compared to their background. Because if you want to check something, then you have to compare also the background, the context. You have to have control variables. And here, I introduce for the first time in this class the word control variable. You have to control for something. Again, this is why I meant that it is not something meaningful or accurate if you don't describe what are first of all, your logical system, I mean the think model that we discussed earlier, mind map, that's one thing, and how the different variables are related to the other in case you are doing a quantitative analysis, certainly, and also very often in case you are doing a qualitative analysis as well. It was impossible to do the analysis of the sectoral systems if we didn't have a theoretical model of how different variables are depending on what. I mean, which variables are the independent variables and which variables are the explanatory variables. For instance, is it R&D in this case here an explanatory variable or a dependent variable? Let me ask. It's absolutely dependent on how you create your think, the map model, isn't it? So, because if you do that, then if the question is that you want to explain the innovation, and of course R&D is a very important part of innovation, it is obvious that R&D is your dependent variable. Huh? We agree on that? And of course, your exogenous independent variables, and mind you, we are not now into a quantitative analysis, it's a general analysis. You would like to have what is the technology that is used, meaning number of patents, or the knowledge, number of patents, or number of publications within a particular area, and so on. That somehow may explain and provide some input into how are we going to explain the differences of R&D and the difference eventually in other. It has been mentioned here, investment in infrastructure. Other variables that also may be dependent and also related under the whole concept of innovation. Well, I hope that I'm not far out. I hope that you follow. I'm not too sure if you follow or not. I hope if I'm really far out, please stop me. And yeah.
Maybe just to provide a simple example of dependent and independent variables. Like, let's say once you would do this innovation study, maybe a simple version, where the dependent variable would be money flow. You could kind of control how much money goes into a business, and then you could have the dependent value as innovation work in that business. So the independent variable is money flow, and the dependent
value
is business.
Yeah, I agree on that. Yes, I agree on that. This is absolutely valid, yeah. And this makes sense. Then you provide a valid ground for what the Commission is doing, trying to define different sectors in order to understand the different innovation modes and styles within different sectors into high tech, low tech, and medium tech, depending on how much investment, how much they invest in R&D compared to their turnover. This is exactly the point. Is it correct or not? That's another question, but this is a model. Can we compare that with another model and then compare these two models, see which one is the more powerful and have more explanatory power? This is research.
Thank you.
Okay, so the funny thing is that I do not have my book. And I see that it is 16:09, so we need to have a small pause, I suppose, a break. So we take a 10-minute break, and I'm sorry, it was 9 minutes. It's far too long. I'm sorry about that. We take 10 minutes.
Okay.
to remember to. That was. I'm sorry for you. I'm just saying that once again, the internal validity we are trying to see, look at the page 103. And then the example two, particularly that one, an industrial psychologist. And it is a quite interesting example, actually. So if I am allowed to read very quickly and loudly, pay attention, I'm sorry also for my accent, because it's not by no means a perfect British accent, so apologies for that. So I will try to read as smoothly and as slowly as possible. It's the example number two. An industrial psychologist wants to study the effects of soft classical music on the productivity of a group of typists in a typing pool. So you understand? We have a typist in their room, and the guy wants to measure the productivity if he is going to play soft classical music or not. That's the setting. Okay. The researcher asks all 30 of the first grade teachers, at the beginning of the month, the psychologist meets with the typist to explain the rationale for the study. So he explains why he gets their consent to play the music during the working day, and then begins to have music piped into the office where the typists work. At the end of the month, the typist supervisor reports a fantastic 30% increase in the number of documents completed by the typing pool that month. Classical music increases productivity, the psychologist concludes. Can you find any fallacies in this particular method? And
well, the most obvious one is that he actually assesses what he's doing. So he's actually... You could argue that he actually motivates them by telling them what he's doing. So that could have an influence on their work morale, for example.
Yeah.
The other thing, to make it more valid, he would provide the same information about his study to a control group without providing the music to kind of...
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. It is the introduction of what is valid and what is valid. He doesn't have any control group, number one. And the second one, which is very close to what you said, Ender, it is that you are suggesting something, you are imposing, and this is typical, this kind of studies, they do have almost all the time productivity effects the first period, the first 2 or 3 months. And then you see a drop into the standard level. I mean, if this is... has a significant difference, then you should have a much, I mean, not 1 month, probably a year, and look at the results. And then you have, first of all, and most important, it is the introduction of a control group. Now, there are two ways of controlling, and control is very important. It's a key concept for us. The idea of controlling, when you're doing a regression analysis, which is, we will come back to that, of course, but a regression analysis is basically when you believe that one variable, which is almost always stochastic variable, I will come back to, again, also the definition of stochastic variable, but the point is that when something like y depends on a function of some exogenous variables and of some coefficients. Let me call the coefficients like betas, and also the exogenous variables like xes, and of course you can have as many as you want, from 1 to the n. So as soon as you have something like that in your mind, then the point is that some of these variables that you're using here may be control variables. A control variable here is, for instance, based on the example I mentioned earlier of Oslo School, it can be the education background of your parents. Let's say that this is the grades of a kid. Imagine now that here we have very
let me call it J, this one, because we have very, let's say that we have 40,000 kids here. Huh? And you have, let's say, that this N is 10, meaning that we have 10 variables. Hmm? So one of these variables, let's say the X4, is the, do you have, I mean, this is not by, I'm not coming with a fictitious example. This is absolutely what has been done. Huh? It is the area where you are living in this particular city. This is a control variable. Area. The other one, the X5, is the group of the income of your parents. Or the actual income, depends. You can create a group variable or you can have the actual income as a variable. The 16 could be the background of your parents. From Norway, not from Norway. Yeah. And again, I know that this variable has been used extensively in these particular studies. These are control variables. Because for us it is obvious to think that you have to include something about income, probably not area of living, but obviously it has something to do with, after all, there may be some differences, and there are actually some differences between whether you live in the western part of Oslo compared to the eastern part of Oslo, isn't it? We know that there are, and we know actually that there are a lot of correlations between these and these other variables. But, you know, this is one way of controlling this. So some of these variables could be, this one could be one and zeros, isn't it? One ethnic Norwegian, zeros non-ethnic Norwegians, for example. Huh? If you have 40,000, probably you can even have, you would like to enter here some of the country background, and so on. All these are a kind of what I mean with control variables here. The type of control that Andre mentioned is a different kind. This is, we are going to see these kinds of things back again when we are going to approach the issue of regression analysis. The kind of the control group that Andre mentioned now is nothing else than the experiment. How you design an experiment. And you have to design, again, experiment and quasi experimental designs. I just point to this book, not for you to buy, but it's a very nice book, and it is of inspiration for me. It goes much more detail compared to our book, but our book is few pages. I really recommend that you read this book about the chapter about experiments, and the whole point of it is that somehow you have to have a control on what you try to explain. And how are you going to explain, how are you going to have a credible, valid result if you do not treat the same way, if you do not treat two groups, one looking at the development of productivity, by saying that I want to study your productivity. How would conduct the control group here? I would have two groups. The one, I want to study your productivity, exactly the same as the guy did it, without playing the music, and the other with playing the music. Then you could say that probably, if there are significant differences, then you can say probably the soft music, classical music, has some effects. We agree? We agree on that, isn't it? So please think all the time, depending on what kind of approach you are using, think all the time whether it is possible to think about or designs where I can control all the time what I'm doing. Andrew.
Just a question about, as an example, doing surveys. Would you recommend doing the same thing in surveys? Like, if you're looking for a specific phenomenon, and you do a series of questions that kind of highlight how that phenomena would affect certain things. Would you do like split the survey in two, with one using the phenomena as an explaining variable, and the other one kind of excluding that variable just to see, is that a way of doing it?
Yeah, excellent question.
I can provide one example.
I'm not so sure, 100% sure, that by referring to the example of BIA, the evaluation of BIA.
If you, let's say that you are interested to see whether a project which is funded and got and funded by the Research Council of Norway has an effect or not. I mean, how are you going to, the project is a tiny thing. A company is a small, much bigger thing, depending on hundreds of different variables, hundreds of different processes. And the question is, can really a project make a difference? How are you going to tell? This is a nightmare of a question for all that want to evaluate a research, research activities, research programs and their effects. And of course, it has been a very big, very fruitful development of methodologies within this area. From the start, where you only look at the companies that get the funding from the Research Council of Norway, or innovation, or whatever EU, whatever, and you try to get to guess as best as you can the possible effect. You are trying to measure actually the possible effects without necessarily being able to say something like that. So you can come with a semi-quasi-experimental design, which is the following. First, you know that we have, let's say, 2,000 companies receiving some contributions from the Research Council of Norway. Let's call it LCN. These are 2,000 companies of LCM. So each one of these, let's say that you then choose 200 out of these 2,000, and you call them, then you have an index, obviously. You have 1 to 200. And these are, you know, that these are all the companies that they receive LCN funding. So here they're ones. Each one of these, you try to match with a twin. I mean, this is a company in Gjøvik with 20 employees, with so much turnover, and within manufacturing. Is there another company like that that never received LCN funding? If yes, you are lucky, then you can match it. So you have one square here, and of course, on that variable, whether it is LCN receiver or not, then you have zeros here. And you're doing the same with, let's say, all 200, or how many you can. Then you have a control group. And then you do whatever you did. The only thing is that you can perfectly, quasi-experimentally, then divide these and study their development, study how they started. For instance, let's say that we have data from 10 years back, and so it's a very hard work to do that. These kind of studies are very expensive, but this is the only credible studies where you can say, yes, I make a difference as a researcher culture of Norway. And this is what you find here from this, the study of Statistics Norway, presented in this evaluation, is this kind of study. Fantastic study, actually. Perfect. It's really, you feel that this is quality here. Huh? Yes, Lucas.
I just got a question back to the example of the classical music. So we just proved that this example or this result is internally not valid because the researcher didn't use the methods, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But potentially. Yeah? Because we are potentially internal non-valid.
Mm-hmm. But why potentially?
But because the method is not perfect, but of course the result, if we do it right, it remains to be seen whether it will be verified or not. Probably not. We know that it's not. In this particular case, it's not. We know that. But you see, so you are claiming something that it may be correct, but because of your method, you cannot tell.
And it's really interesting what Lucas said, because it's important to see the importance of research that has validity problems, because as long as the researcher sees the problems and admits to the problem, it's still useful research.
Because you can say, I mean, for all the other studies that they know, there are many, many studies that they never adopt this kind of approach, studying effects of the research culture on Norway. I did several of them. This one, never, because this is much more difficult. You have to, you have to have the right people, the right data, and of course also we have to be in the statistics of Norway, because they are bathing in data that not necessarily other researchers are doing that. So that's another question. But the point is that of course we know that this is a problem, and still you can validate and say, okay, on the basis of what we did, we can measure that potential effects may be of that kind of million, which I often used, let's say 10 million crowns compared to the 1 or 2 or 5 million that is actually here. It is the point is that very often 1 crown from public support, it provides 1 to 1.9 additionality, as we call it. So for 1 crown, then you have 1 additional crown with this company, wealth creation, added value. This is the normal result that you can find from this kind of studies. So the whole point here is that what kind of claims you are doing after according to what you did. If your claim is that I know for sure that the productivity increased for 30%, then it's not, of course, a right claim.
For example, if you say, I claim that it increased, but neglecting the fact that I didn't have a control group, etc., then you would be like, you would be right, and somebody else could do further research on that, for example.
Yes, exactly.
His failure.
Yes.
So to say.
Yes. I didn't have the resources to do a research with a control group.
Yeah.
On that basis, the results I found is conditional to that. The conditionality here, it is the whole point. It is the accurate and credible. And please, look, this sounds a little bit theoretical, but if you write in your master thesis that the productivity increased to 30%, it is very close to get a D. You see? If you write that, yeah, I haven't had the resources to do that and that and that, so and on the basis of that, I can conclude in that and that and that, but we have to be careful because we do not know that and that and that. This is a perfect result, and you get an A. That's the difference, actually. You agree? You understand? I mean, this has a direct effect on how you were writing your master thesis.
Yeah, I would go as far as to say that as long as my research has severe validity weaknesses, I would never make a claim. I would just kind of say that
tendencies, indications.
Certain indications.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, and that's valid as well, huh? That's okay. It's a small contribution to a concrete problem where others can also contribute and follow up and refer to the indications. The indication has been validated by my study as well. This is exactly the point, because you're never alone. You contribute to some small, tiny stone, and then the next one refers to what you're doing. This is why it's important also to publish as well. And then you build a body of knowledge, which is, I mean, if everyone validates everyone, then even if you don't have a control group, probably you should think, okay, here we have some serious findings. You agree on that, isn't it?
Okay, so this is where I think that we, with a very nice way, and we through the discussion, we managed to conclude or to mention strategies for different approaches about the internal validity. But the controlled laboratory study is what we more or less we discuss now, a double blind experiment. This is what we are going to see an example in SPSS. And the thing is that a double-blind experiment is that neither the researcher nor the, and this is typical in medicine, medical experiments. And by the way, if I may enter one parenthesis again, there is the main body of our medical knowledge, it's statistical knowledge. It's not actual knowledge. It's not theoretical knowledge of how we know that this produced this effect, this medicine produced these effects because of all the logical series of things. If you have this series and you are a good researcher, then you get a Nobel Prize. The majority of the medical knowledge we have is on the basis of statistical findings and probabilities. We do not know exactly why smoke is harmful for our health. Exactly, all the different logical implications, other than of course the general that the lungs get hurt. Yeah? For instance, if you have lung cancer or others. Cancer cases. Now I'm far from my field, as you understand that very well, and so I will not. I don't. I think it's very valid what I'm saying. That there is the majority of medical, particularly clinical trials, is based exactly on that. It's based on the trusting the blind experiment method, and you're trusting that you are having 2 or 5 or 10 different groups, and you are providing them with a treatment. And this treatment, you never know whether, neither as a person involved in these groups, nor as a researcher. So the doctor or the researcher never knows what kind of treatment you provided to your group. And we're talking about now, it may be 20,000 persons involved in these kind of clinical trials, extremely expensive experiments. Huh? And then you have, of course, 200 researchers. No one knows exactly whether they provide the medicine that you want to test or not. On this particular end, so you avoid the issue of trying to, you are... with your attitude, with your non-verbal signs of your body or your face, you can manipulate the people, the persons involved in the experiment, because it is absolutely possible that one is we have the body language, as we call it. I mean, there are hundreds of different ways to manipulate results that we do not really understand that yet. Huh? So, but the blind, double blind, this at least excludes this possibility, because you don't know. And that goes to the tree. It's a very strong argument that you have always to think about different methods when you're doing a research, otherwise it must be more conditioned. When you have two different methodological approaches that coincide, triangulation, this is the point, that coincide, that you arrive to the same, and I mean the same, not that you want to be the same, but logically is provide the same result independently, then you can write a claim
that it, my results are more valid than based on one finding. And just one small thing. One of the reasons that the Research Council of Norway commissioned the evaluation of BIA to different research groups, it's also, it's a part of it. I don't think that that was a conscious choice of the Research Council of Norway in doing this BIA evaluation assessment. But it is the result is that there are different research groups that are doing their own research, and they are arriving to some results. And then you have an expert group trying to gather all that and to finally arrive to a synthesis of these results, independently from these. So if all the four studies arrive to the same conclusion, that the funding from ACN was important for the development of whatever, then obviously it's much more potent result compared to one of the three arrived at that. The others didn't find anything. Isn't it? And
I would like to, just a thought experiment. Let's say you're doing a quantitative study. I would say that there's a difference between observed phenomena, all research that has to do with people directly, and that you can affect them or that the environment can affect them, and just pure number study. Because it's kind of, at least in my head, it's easier to control the validity when you're just dealing with numbers and statistics, because you can factor things like outliers and kind of mathematical rules and statistical phenomena like size of the data material and so on. Yeah. So that it's kind of mathematical and statistical rules starts to kind of be its own validity in sort. If you have like numbers for the same questions for like four or five past studies, they kind of provide their own validity in some sort.
They can or they cannot?
They can,
yeah.
Because as long as you, when you're researching people directly, there's a lot of factors that you can't control, and that kind of makes it harder to make a valid study.
Yeah, but this is the typical, and of course, as you know, I am already biased in this particular case because I am much more quantitative researcher. At least I would believe that. And of course, I would. My immediate urge is to agree with you. But again, look, you have the other side. There is no doubt that a certain kind of attitude, a certain kind of thinking, a certain kind of also theoretical bias can also infuse your questions of your questionnaire. While if you are a little bit at least more consciously try to be more objective and you face your interview, interview object, the person that you want to interview, then you have always the possibility to, he says something different compared to what I expected. And this is the main, because look, on the basis of the actual facts and figures, almost everything we have, except of the purely economic data, are in the final and answers from people. I mean, the R&D statistics and the innovation statistics, that are all answers from companies. We have studies on that. How reliable are these kind of answers? Who is answering them? How valid are they? We have actually studies on that. It's a very interesting methodological studies funded by the European Commission, by the way. So it is a very important. As soon as you've done something in a good methodological approach, with a good methodological approach, no matter which kind of approach you have, then it should have been valid. One of the problems Probably I would close with that. Thank you for it's fantastic having this discussion. But of course, one of the problems is not necessarily the methodological approach, is the wrapping up how you are reporting. And of course, when you have quantitative data, you are in a completely different world compared to sit with page after page after page of texts that you have to analyze. That's the big, big, big challenge with quantitative research that we will touch upon next time. Not that much, because next time we have to build on the quantitative aspect. There is quite a lot of that in the book, which I have to return, actually. Thank you very much for borrowing.
And by the way, very expressive book. I didn't know. I thought that it was only 300 grams, and it is
more than almost five. But remember that. It needs a lot of maturity in order to build and provide a credible reporting of a qualitative research based on interview compared to data, compared to a survey, or compared even to secondary data, analysis of economic data, or of patterns of publications which you found there. And here I absolutely agree with you. And this is not solved. We don't have a method saying that this is the best method to report the results from an interview or for a case study. It is completely, craftsmanship based. Thank you very much for today. Thank you for being so late as well together with me. And we'll see each other next time.